It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out of this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Transform your home in one weekend and get big savings on everything for your project at Menards. Menards carries the largest selection of Purdy painting tools you need to get your painting project started. From brushes, paint, roller covers, and even paint kits. Hurry in and save big money on Purdy painting supplies. Get everything you need for your painting project at Menards. Plus, check out Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turn Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, very much requested on this show, from the band Le Tigre, from the zine and band Bikini Kill, and author of the must-read new book, Rebel Girl, Kathleen Hanna, is on the show today. And this is a great episode. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who is the show producer and the guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show. You can find me over on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. There is a YouTube page, a TikTok page, an Instagram page, and a Facebook page, all for this podcast. And all of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. To support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let all your friends know that we do this podcast twice a week here, and that there's tons of episodes in the catalog too. And spread the word that way. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have records. We have tour dates that we're going to be announcing soon. And I appreciate your support on that front too. All right, that's it for me. On to today's show. As I said off the top, huge guest, Kathleen Hanna, is on this podcast. Someone I've wanted to talk to for years. I've never actually spoken to her in any way, shape, or form prior to sitting down to do this interview. So this is someone that I was very excited to get to do this with. And as I said off the top as well, she has a fantastic new book that is a must read. It is called Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk. And this book is out in a few weeks now, actually. I've had it pre-ordered forever. On May 14th, it will be hitting store shelves. And I've read it. It is a very powerful book. There's a lot of incredible stuff in it. I don't want to spoil too much of it. This interview doesn't really spoil stuff. It's more like hints and teasers for what's to come inside this thing. So I don't want to spoil this episode by rambling on too much about it in advance. Check out the episodes also with Toby Vale from Bikini Kill and Kathy Wilcox from Bikini Kill, one of the most important punk bands, certainly of my lifetime. Actually, most of the punk bands, I guess, are in my lifetime. There's like 3 years before my lifetime. Well, I guess proto-punk and stuff. Anyway, Bikini Kill, one of the most important punk bands ever in anyone's lifetime. And that's it. I'm not going to ramble on too much. They got tour dates. Go check out BikiniKill.com. They're maybe coming to a town near you. And go and see them live. It's fantastic. And that's Bikini Kill. If you don't know Bikini Kill, you know what it's. Anyway, sit back, relax, and enjoy Kathleen Hanna on Turned Out a Punk. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm very excited to talk to you, Damien.
Well, I'm very excited to talk to you. I feel like this conversation for me is like 30 years in the making this year, because I've wanted to talk to you since, well, the mid-90s when I first got into this music. And, throughout all the stuff you've done and now having read your book, there's just so many
questions.
You read
the book!
Oh, I love it. It's a hard read. There's a lot of stuff you're like very forthcoming about, a lot of experiences. And so it's weird to say like I love it like it's a laugh ride or something, but
yeah,
it is.
But it's like liking, you know, a really tough political post.
Exactly.
On the internet where you're like, should I put a heart next to this? I'm really appreciative. This person's educating me or telling me that they're supportive of, you know, something that I care about, but it's like, should I be liking it? Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Well, hopefully it wasn't too hard of a read. I tried to make the chapters short so that people could set it down when they needed to and give themselves a break. But I don't think it's not all like trauma. Like, yeah, I think there's a lot of, hopefully there's a lot of joy in there. I worked pretty hard to find the joy. So,
well, it's fun as like a fan of the band outside of the trauma stuff. I mean, like to be able to finally contextualize a lot of the stuff that in a pre-internet era you're just kind of like piecing together from zine fragments or something someone told you, and so to kind of have it all laid out, I'm like, oh my gosh, it like really brought me back to time and places of like learning about this stuff or hearing about these things or finding the records and stuff. So a fantastic book. But
I'm interested to know, since like you're somebody who's kind of like a super fan of punk in general, you know what I mean, like what was interesting to you about that you didn't know, that you were like, is it like the Smells Like Teen Spirit story, or is it like, you know, just like, oh, what it felt like to go on stage in the 90s, or you know what I mean, or the thing of, you know, we're one of the last generations that's going to have experienced both, like kind of analog, you know, in real life stuff, and then digital. And so for me, I've started to realize that there's going to be an audience. I'm hoping there's going to be an audience of people who are more in our age group who are like identify with that thing, because that's a really big shift that happened that occurs in real time in the book. And I don't talk about it as a subject. It's just kind of in the background, but I don't know. I'm just trying to find out, like, as somebody who loves a lot of punk music and knows a lot about it, what was interesting to you?
Well, I kind of, it made me really think about it. And, out of the 90s punk, like there's a lot of bands that emerged that kind of like shape this culture or shift things. But most of those things happened to the mainstream and affected the mainstream music. Like underground music didn't need Nirvana. Mainstream music needed Nirvana. And eventually Nirvana repopulates the underground. But in the same way Green Day and Rancid, like they had already done their time in the underground. Bikini Kill changed the underground. Like it's fascinating to kind of go back to that time and place where I'm just first getting into it and kind of like learning about this stuff and kind of seeing things, but how much it shifted to where punk is now. And it's yourselves, it's bands, Bratmobile, like Babes in Toyland, who you talk a lot about, Frightwig, yeah, who I didn't even know about till I started doing this podcast. Specifically, Bikini Kill and Riot Girl, because it was something to kind of galvanize the scene and change things. And it's just, yeah. So I think from a punk perspective, it's a hugely important way to look in on something that shifted this culture.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting because there's so many great things that have happened in feminist punk or whatever people want to call it, you know, like femme fronted, or, you know, there's already so many great singers and so many great people in bands and so many great women who are organizing and doing a lot of stuff. And I think that a lot of what happened in the 90s was just giving it a name.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was already happening. It wasn't that it didn't happen. It was more like, hey, you all, let's all acknowledge that this is happening and that we're trying to change the underground for the better, and that women have been trying to do this forever and since the beginning of punk, when I think it was way more egalitarian back then. Although there were still horrible, hideous problems. I don't know. I feel like, you know, we definitely stood on the shoulders of a lot of other people who came before us, and we were learning from them. And I think I always felt like a super fan. I'm like one of those annoying super fan people who's like, you know, like, oh my God, I met Alice Bag, and she's like this lovely person, and like everything that you could hope for as a fan when you meet somebody, you know what I mean? Like, and to become peers with, you know, one of your heroes is just like, and get to work with her was amazing, and talk about, oh, what was it like back then in the scene, you know, versus what is it like now, and stuff like that. But,
well, I think it's interesting with Alice Bag specifically, because when she was on the show, she's always involved in punk and always involved in underground music, but the way she talked about how it's changed now versus back then, and obviously, like you said, you're standing on the shoulders of giants and people that helped clear this path, but naming it and giving it space and it is so important, I think. And just we'll get into all this stuff, I'm sure, but I gotta start it off, Kathleen, the way they all start off, which is, how did you get into punk from the first time you ever came across the word?
I guess I should have thought about this before because of the title of your podcast, but of course I didn't. How did I find out about punk? You know, I found out about punk on TV, on Night Flight, the TV show Night Flight. I mean, that show blew my mind in a lot of ways, but I think I saw like Liquid Sky, which maybe would be considered more like new wave or whatever, but I was like, wait, what is this? Like, you know, women with like hot pink hair, and, you know, there's also the queer element in that movie that I was like, oh, I think I need to go be alone after I watch this. But you know what I mean? Like, it was just like Liquid Sky was a big thing, and it was on Night Flight. And what else did they have on Night Flight? I think I saw a part of the Fabulous Stains on Night Flight, but it didn't register with me. I was like walking through the room and I was like, there's girls playing punk music. So I always loved that the way that I got into it was on TV, because it always made me remember that, like, especially, you know, pre-internet, people who didn't live, like, I lived in like a small suburbs in Maryland, and I lived actually really close to, this is, you know, Brendan and Guy from Fugazi. And like, I lived a few miles away from where that was going on at the time it was going on. And I didn't know about it because I was, you know, in junior high, and my sister listened to Molly Hatchet and Alabama. So I wasn't really, and we did listen to Cheech and Chong and smoke a lot of pot, but like, I didn't know that this huge punk thing was happening 3 miles away from me. And that's how isolated you can be if you're not in the know, especially pre-internet. And I think even with the internet, you know, it does take having access to the internet and all of that kind of stuff. So this like popular medium of television, you know, I probably saw I was a big Quincy. I don't know if you remember the show Quincy. And you know about the Quincy punks. There was a punk episode of Quincy that I think some people from Verbal Assault.
Extras In or something?
Were Extras In. Because there's two Verbal Assaults. There's Verbal Assault East and Verbal Assault West.
Verbal Abuse, is it?
Verbal Abuse, baby, yeah.
Yeah, like the Yeah, that makes sense too, because yeah, there's some punks in the crowd, and there's but like you're saying, these moments are really important, and you talk about it in the book too, when you start getting into the rejection of Nirvana post them signing to the major label from the underground. But it's so important to have these waving the flag moments in mainstream culture for kids to kind of find out about this stuff in a pre-internet world where you didn't have access to this information unless you stumbled across or had a cool sibling.
Yeah. I mean, representation is really important, but it's not legislation. That's how I think about it is like, even now, like, seeing women who are more my age playing music, I'm always like, oh, it just makes me feel better. It makes me feel validated. It makes me feel like I have a community. Or seeing actresses my age in movies that I like or whatever can make me feel more validated and stuff. But yeah, I think representation is super duper important. And what were you talking about?
Oh, we're just talking about how these pop cultural moments where this stuff shows up on mainstream places is key to kind of
Yeah, no, and
understanding.
sometimes it's like it's good to be conscious of that and be like, yeah, it's okay to have a song in a movie that, what one of the interesting thing, Bikini Kill was mentioned by Julia Stiles, the actress who was in this teen movie in the 90s or early 2000s called 10 Things I Hate About You or Like Hate About You, I think, with Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
And in the movie, I hadn't seen, I saw it like a few years ago, but it was like in the movie, he's like trying to like get attention from her or something. He's like, oh, are you into Bikini Kill? I'm into Bikini or something like that. But I guess it's also mentioned in the book. And I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, I found out about your band because of that movie. And I'm like, and we didn't make that happen or anything. That was just a thing. Like Julia Stiles was a fan and she asked to put it in the film. And thank you, Julia Stiles. But it was this thing that's how I would have found out about Bikini Kill.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I wasn't somebody who had access. So I'm always kind of conscious of that, even though I think the way that we're thought about within the underground community is kind of like purists or $5 shows, never selling out. I mean, maybe people will feel differently about it now that we're playing more expensive shows, but the sellout conversation is kind of gone by the wayside for which is awesome. I do think the way people do business, if they choose to do it ethically or not, is really important. But I think that focusing on, bands, which are partially small businesses, which are like a four-person small business, and pointing to them as the people who have to be like holding the entire culture, up or doing, always doing the perfect thing when it's like four people, instead of going after multinational corporations that are, doing disaster capitalism around the world, you start to kind of be like, where are we really putting our priorities? Like, oh, I didn't like that lyric and I'm going to boycott you. And I totally think criticism is like the only way a band's going to grow, the only way a scene is going to grow. But I think that the thing of being like, I don't like that one lyric, you're dead to me forever. And you're just as bad as Steve Jobs, or
Yeah.
you know what I mean? It's like the amount in the 90s, the inflation of Bikini Kill's power was definitely a problem. Like we didn't have the power to like, tell the president what to do, but people kind of acted like we had this power. And the inflation of people's power who don't have it is actually a very big mind fuck. And and something that's interesting that happens in the punk scene. Like people act like Rollins is God. He's just like some dude who collects snakes. Like,
That's the I guess great fallacy in punk is there's like no gods and masters except for the people in the bands that we turn into gods and masters. And it's interesting because I find so much stuff in the book that I find fascinating, but like there's that moment where you're kind of talking about how there's like a certain amount of economic privilege that's required for like punk purity. Like to be able to go and play free shows means like no, you got someone else paying the gas because that stuff's not free. And there is this sort of thing in punk rock where like people build up this edifice around the person on stage where it doesn't necessarily even have a relationship to who that person is after a certain point. Like Ian MacKaye, the person, and Ian MacKaye, the character that sits inside many a young punk kid's heart, is kind of different in my experience, you know, and not in a bad way, but just like in a real way, that there's a human being and then there's sort of this chaste image.
Yeah. I mean, I think I used an example in the book of like being at parties in DC and someone holding a beer and being like, oh, Ian's coming. He might see you drinking a beer, you know, or like you're eating a cheeseburger and it's like, watch out, Ian might see you. And it's like, he's not a narc. You know what I mean? And like, I feel like I've occupied that similar space in terms of feminism of like, you know, oh, you know, you have like a sexist magazine out in your house and I come over to do an interview, or like a, you know, a magazine with like a girl in a bikini on the cover. And like, I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, I don't care about you. Like that's been a lot of things, is like guilty dudes coming up to me, like, you know, being like trying to show me how, you know, oh, you really changed me around. I don't care. Nothing about you. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to absolve you. I'm not Jesus. I'm not going to say like, oh, you used to be sexist and now you're not. Thanks for telling me. I don't care. Like, I'm not thinking about you.
The Jesus thing though is apt, because one thing I've kind of learned from doing this thing is that punk is more religion, and these people on stage end up becoming like deities, and they're giving us a moral compass and they're giving us like a do's and don'ts list in the same way religion gave people a do's and don'ts list in a lot of ways. So yeah, like you become more
add that to branding.
Yeah. It's just hard to make money off it.
Because it's like Jesus, you're doing something off brand, Jesus.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like I very early on realized when we started getting shit for playing with the Go-Go's because the show was sponsored by Budweiser, which like we didn't even know. We just knew we were asked to open for the Go-Go's. And that is a huge deal. I mean, like to me, there's no way I'm going to say no to that. There's absolutely, I don't care. You know, I mean, I guess if they lit an orphanage on fire the day before, maybe I'd say no, but it's like, there's no way I'm going to say no to that.
Yeah.
And it's like the opportunity of a lifetime. And so when we got to do that and then got shit for it, and it was like, you guys are sellouts. I was like, you don't understand who we are. Like, you don't understand what a big honor this is, and you don't care. And you're like, it started to be this thing where I was like, with punk purity, I was like, look, like a lot of my friends are gay and they're getting beat up. Is this really the hill you want to die on? $5 shows, no sponsorship. This is the conversation we're having when, like, you know what I mean? Like, gay kids are getting beat up in the front of shows for being gay. And we're arguing about, oh, so-and-so played a show with this band that has a sponsorship. Really? Who the fuck cares? Or we're talking about barcodes. I mean, punk can do a lot of things. I think that like music, any kind of art, any kind of music can like create like a ground, like a cultural ground where we're supporting people who like don't like a lot of what the government is doing, and who cares about economic injustice and cares about racial injustice and cares about, you know, gender inequity and like all of these things. And we can create a supportive community for that. And we can create a place to have joy around that and a place to get your anger out around that. And that's something that people can bring back into their everyday lives to like, be like, I'm going to keep doing this work that is hard because I can listen to this music when I'm stressed out, or I can go to these shows and get like pumped up. But we don't change laws, and we don't, you know, have the power to be, you know, God.
Well, and I think it's something you kind of touch on in the book too. It's like, what brings a lot of us to punk is trauma, and trauma, as you said in the book, begets trauma in a lot of ways. And so people bring their own bullshit.
Yeah.
Into this place. And
you know, what happens when you're looking for family? Because I feel like that's a big thing, was that I was like, estranged from much of my family, and I was really looking for a family. And I sort of, I found two families. I was finding like a feminist family and a punk family kind of simultaneously, and trying to make that into a cohesive thing. And it's not really meant to be a cohesive thing. It should be a challenging, argumentative thing. It shouldn't be this, and also if you grow up with in a super dysfunctional home, it's like, and you're looking for the opposite of that, you're going to be disappointed, because what is actually awesome and supportive and great isn't going to be the opposite of dysfunction. It's still good. It's going to be challenging and interesting and hard, and there's going to be conflict. And I think I was like just looking for this like unconditional love and the family that I thought I always have, and the support, and not people being like, "You're so great," because that makes me nervous, but just this feeling of, like that this family was going to be a feather bed I could throw myself on. And then when that didn't meet my expectations, I was just absolutely devastated. When I had things happen, like we're like, I don't want to deal with the mainstream media because they asked me really offensive questions about, have you been sexually assaulted? Oh, how can you be a feminist because you're a stripper? Blah, blah, blah. And they were just like, it wasn't this decision of like, I don't want to talk to the mainstream press because I'm trying to be a punk purist. It was literally, for me, it was a mental thing. It was like, I need to save my mental health. Like, I can't go into these interviews, almost always with men who say abusive things to me to get me to react. So they can print me saying, fuck you back to them, and then be like, see, she's a crazy man hater. Like, I just can't put myself into that situation once I knew that was a lot of times the situation. But then it started happening with fanzine, with doing fanzines. And it was, in a way, even worse because it's totally unregulated. It's not like we're meeting in a coffee shop. We're meeting in an alley behind a club after the show. And the thing that I wrote about in the book that started happening was really devastating. Like, these guys would get me alone and start cackling, like date rape guy, like gang rapist, and just start saying the most horrible, awful, cruel things to me with the tape recorder off. And then they would hit record. And it became, and that this is one of my connections with Ian, with Ian MacKay, and why I started like being like, hey, will you hang out with me when I would be in DC? Because I was like, I know this shit happens to him. Like, because people would come to Fugazi shows and specifically scream mean stuff at Ian to get him to react, because they wanted the punk rock badge, like a Boy Scout badge of like punk rock honor. Like, Ian MacKay yelled at me. And it's like, again, it's like, I thought we were punks, and the whole idea is that we're all participating. But if you're starting to treat him like he's like Bruce Willis, and you want to see the veins pop out of his neck because he's Bruce Willis, what's the difference between the mainstream scene and the punk scene? And that for me was devastating when it started happening to me, and guys were like, trying to get me to yell, I fucking hate you, into their tape recorder so they could, I guess, play it for their friends or jack off to it later or whatever. And I was like, this is like unpaid sex work right now. Like, I'm not engaging in this. But it was devastating because I really care about fanzines, and I really care about people making their own media that is not controlled by corporations. So what happens when we get that power and we do exactly the same thing that crappy corporate mainstream publications do?
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
That's just sad.
well, like you're saying, like people come here looking for a family. So in a fucked up way, people on the stage are made into their parents, and like yelling at your parents and getting to say, "No, fuck you, dad," to Ian, or "Fuck you, mom," to you, is like the
Oh,
power
they call
that.
me grandma. They don't call me mom anymore. They call
Yeah,
me grandma.
but there's just like the insecurity that drives so much of this stuff, and the way we cling to these four letters that ultimately have different definitions to every single person. And I think, like you said, why is the book so interesting to me as someone obsessed with punk is also because I think Bikini Kill is a band that is unlike any other band in how many different worlds you exist in at the same time in the 90s, which is such a tumultuous period for this music. Like, we can talk about Bikini Kill in terms of the involvement in DC hardcore, but also like Ebullition Records and Born Against and that whole world. But then mainstream pop punk stuff, like I read about you guys, I think first time in Rancid's liner notes, or Nirvana, or like opening the Go-Go's, and Newsweek's talking about you. And it's just like, you were a DIY.
I said the Metal Church record too. Don't forget that.
That's on the list of questions. Believe me, I asked Allison about it already when she was on the show. Because, well, that's a, and that's a direct connection to the history, right? Because that's pre-Lude, or Lude is Metal Church is post-Lude, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So it goes right back to the history of punk with Metal Church as well. So I don't know. It's just a, it must have been a very fraught period. And I know from reading it, it was a fairly fraught period to exist in, but it's also from a historical perspective, just a amazing way to kind of view what was happening through Bikini Kill, and just how threatened people were by it. Like, at the same time, how much people immediately got it and embraced it and were like, this band's important. But then just like you're saying, like people that just couldn't compute how upsetting it was, and how Riot Girl at a certain point became a four-letter word in a bad way to some people, because they were just like, no, it's Riot Girl, like all this baggage they were sticking on this thing. But it's, yeah, anyway, I'm just pontificating now.
No, I love it. I love it. I mean, I just haven't heard very many people's reactions to the book, and the things, just hearing the things that it brought up for you is really interesting to me, because I'm just interested in people's in what different people, the same way you were just saying, like, oh, you know, we were in like Newsweek, but we were also, you know, in the Rancid liner notes, and, you know, like
in Heart Attack.
Yeah. We were on an Ebullition compilation, and, you know, like all these different things. We were on an Outpunk compilation. We were just in a lot of different places. And I feel like, when I wrote the book, I didn't think anything at all about like who's going to read this. I just wrote it. Like, I just wrote it because I had to write it. And I wish I was lying and that I actually had a strategic lens, but I was really like, I'm going to write everything down and then I'm going to strategically edit it. But I just wrote everything. And even when I was editing, I just couldn't have an audience member in mind. Like, I just couldn't. And so I'm hoping that, you know, it's something, I feel like there's the me that's an insider baseball punk that like is, I'm not as much as Toby, never as much as Toby.
Toby's on another level. Like,
Toby's on some other like egg punk versus, I don't even know what she's talking about half the time. So sometimes I'm like, will you explain the difference between this and this? Just because it's really fun to watch her get like say the whole thing, even if I'm not super interested in it. Her explanations of things are really entertaining. And I know I shouldn't use her for entertainment, but she's so much better than TV. And she knows so much. Like, it's really like she could run some kind of school or something. But I do have a certain, you know, love of like music, like all kinds of music. Like, you know, I talk about Tracy Chapman in the book. I talk about Janet Jackson, like, you know, I wasn't just listening to punk ever. Like, a lot of times I stopped with the mainstream for a really long time. And so I didn't even know, like, people would, I was like, yeah, I sort of am aware of Alanis Morissette, but I don't really have an opinion. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I wasn't really paying attention to mainstream television or me. I wasn't in it because I was in a cult. I was in a cult. All my friends, you know, there's a lot of people for I'm 55. So people my age, there's a lot of people who grew up in cults. I've met like four or five people who've grown up in cults, and they don't know what like H.R. Puffin stuff is, or like a bunch of the Sid and Marty Krofft things, or like even Three's Company. Like, I'll be like, oh, Three's Company, you know, Jack and Chrissy or like whatever. And they have no clue what I'm talking about because they were in a cult. And then I think about this period in from probably 89 to like 98, 99, where I just wasn't paying attention to mainstream culture. I still listened to, you know, like Whitney Houston, like, and I still always listen to George Michael because I just love him. And I was never like, I can't listen to this because I'm a, you know, punk, but it was like, I wasn't really paying attention to the mainstream. I had a couple artists I like that are more mainstream. But those are sort of my, like, I wasn't in, punk's not a cult. I don't want to say that, but
No, it is
was
100%.
there's part of it that's like, especially, Olympia is a very particular place, and also DC, and there is like dogma and like all this stuff. And once I left, I was like, I did kind of feel like I was deprogramming myself, but I had started that already because I just started being like, this punk purity thing is not for me. It's starting to seem really binary. It's starting to seem really like, this is what you do to be a good punk, and this means, and the goalposts are always changing. And especially with for people who say, hey, I'm a feminist, or I care about the state of the world, I want to, it's like the goalposts will really change, and if people were mad that we were getting attention, even if the attention was, you guys suck, you can't sing, you can't write, you can't play guitar, like, or your band is terrible. Even if that was the press, and you're ugly, and you're a stripper, and you've been raped, and bleh, like nothing about the music, nothing about the songwriting, nothing about like charisma on stage, none of that. Just like, you guys are a piece of shit. And then people in our community are like, we're really mad that you're getting so much attention. And I'm like, seriously, you want this? Like, this attention is really bad. Like, Flipside reviewed our show and just wrote "fuck you" 11 times. Like, you—that's the kind of review that you're like jealous that we got and you didn't.
I think you're exactly right, and I think the it is a cult, and the religious
Wait, so
leader.
are we deprogrammers?
Well, I feel like it's everything's a cult at a certain point, right? Like, like I got a friend who's found a bunch of success in wrestling, and now he's gotten in transcendental meditation, and I heard him doing his indoctrination call, or the call where they get you into it, and I'm like, that sounds a lot like a cult, kind of, not to judge anyone because I think
Oh,
we
yeah.
all need something, right? Like, I needed punk and I needed to fill that, like you're saying, that family void with these people on stage. And this, I needed these people not to give me a moral compass because I knew what was right and wrong, but I needed people to validate these feelings that went against what my peers were saying at the time. Like, I, but then that the same way that the people that do hold stake in these cults and the individual sects of these cults, they have a vested interest in defining punk by their version because you got to give your tithing to them by buying their t-shirts, by going to their shows, by buying their CDs. So, and I don't want to beat up on him because he is like a god to me in the same way you kind of talk about him glowingly. But like, there's that part in the book where Ian comes to you and starts kind of in a concerned way, but still like talking to you about being a stripper and like punk and stripper. It's like, but like, look at the origins of punk rock. There were strippers at the first punk rock shows. This stripping is like sex work in this culture. Dee Dee was a sex worker. Like, it's
Yeah.
not, who's to say what is and isn't punk? Like, we define this thing, but it's a cult. And like all religious cults, you got to keep people in.
Yeah. I think it was more the, I think what people had more of an issue with was the feminist part of it. Like, you can't call yourself a feminist and be doing that at the same time. Which was always ridiculous to me because it's like, if I had access to like a job that let me tour and like paid me enough to live that wasn't that and wasn't waitressing, because I hate waitressing way worse than I hate stripping, but like I would have done it. But I did look, I looked, and it didn't exist. And so it's like, I just think it's like that thing of like creating an economic situation where people are forced to make choices that are not the best, where we have a limited amount of choices and we're forced into this thing by economic situations to do it. And then we're called hypocrites, whereas the kids with the trust funds can play more benefits for domestic violence shelters than I can, because I had to work and I couldn't take off work, every weekend to play a benefit. And I think the whole thing of punk starting, I mean, people, we can have this argument. I probably shouldn't bring this up on your show of all places, but it's like, punk starting kind of as, a class resistance in working class resistance in England, and then becoming with hardcore, like the suburban, predominantly white suburban rebellion against maybe American goals or the, the American dream or something. And then I think that the conversations around class, at least in the 90s when I was more involved, were very lazy conversations. It was not about, the way that people grew up and the way that some people are basically put in a box in their own minds where you're not able to go above this level. And there was this whole downward mobility to it that is actually really classist, where it's like there's people slumming it in the punk scene, and then but in the end, they can go back to their rich parents and, go to a fancy rehab if they get addicted to drugs. And there's some people who don't have those options. I was middle class, and very lucky that I always had my needs met. But I didn't have a safety net. I don't have an inheritance coming. And obviously my situation is very, very different now because I married someone super rich. Which is really my advice to anyone in the arts is just marry someone super rich. Solves a lot of problems. But yeah, I just think that the reading of class got very shallow and superficial. And it actually, I think precluded a lot of kids who grew up working class and working poor from being involved.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, there's a like the history of punk is written by the people that had the economic means to produce the culture, and the people with the economic means didn't necessarily understand what it was like for the people that didn't have the economic means. I think Jerry A, and I got to talk about Poison Idea with you at some point, when he was on the show, was talking about,
oh yeah, let's talk Insider Baseball now.
We'll get into that, but yeah, he made sort of the same point that you're saying too, is that there's this economic side of punk which was not as discussed. And I think the advent of the cassette tape and the zine, I think, leveled the playing field a lot more, because you could start producing this culture without telling. Anyway, Insider Baseball stuff, the Slayer hippie, your friend in high school, that's awesome.
Oh, Steve?
Yeah, rest in peace, of course. But
I can't believe he died. You know, one of the first things one of the first times I ever went to a punk show was I went with Poison Idea. They took me in their van, and I was like maybe 16 when they played in Seattle. And it was my first time going to Seattle too. And I took pictures of them. I still have them. They're in my archive. They're all of Steve because he was my friend. So I like just took pictures of Steve. But I remember they had like a big cross on stage.
That would
I don't
make
know
sense.
If the band they were opening for had it. But it was like kind of my first like traveling, my first getting a taste of tour. And it was just, driving up for one show. But yeah, he was always super nice to me. And, I sold him weed. And but I mean, I wasn't like super good friends with him, like where I really like totally knew him. But there was this other band at our school that like the most handsome boy at the school, like the handsome rocker guy. And now I can't remember his name. I feel like it was Nick, called Mayhem.
Mayhem from Portland.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh.
And so Mayhem is a palindrome kind of, yeah, it is. It's a palindrome, and their logo, you could flip it upside down and it would still say Mayhem somehow.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, this like super hot guy who was in almost all my classes, who had like this great hair, he was in that band. And so like we had all these high school bands, like I went to this one school, Grant, for a while, and like people were in bands at that school. And I was like, what the heck? Like, I just thought it was all guys, but it was like pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like, man, Steve's you're in an actual band, Steve. He's a good drummer. Like, I gotta say, he's a good drummer.
And also I think he's like, he doesn't really get the credit he deserves as like a engineer producer, because he did that Heat Miser record. Neil from Heat Miser was on the show and talked about how Steve was like a key factor in their early recording stuff.
Yeah. And he was the person who basically was like, come to my show. You're a part of this. You know, and me and my two girlfriends would go to see Poison Idea. And then we started seeing, like, you know, we saw Miracle Workers. I saw, like, all of the, you know, Corrosion of Conformity and, like, all the stuff that happened in Portland was very fascinating. I actually had to take out a section talking about when I started going to reggae. I quit going to any punk shows because there started being fights first because speed metal came in, right? So when speed metal came in, the short hair punks and the long hair punks who didn't, like, the long hair dudes didn't call themselves punks. They were like, you know, rockers or metal, started fighting for the front row at these speedcore speed metal shows. Cause it was speedcore. So that started happening where it's like the long hair and the short hair guys are fighting, but it's like still like a bunch of white dudes, right? Just like fighting. And me and my two girlfriends are like the only girls at the shows. And we're like, really? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and then it's all of the white supremacists came into Portland, and then it was the Sharps versus the Nazis and the Nazi punks. And that was very prevalent, like at my high school, like everything. But again, while of course it was the Nazi punks that I'm vehemently against, and the people who were recruited, working class, dudes from my school, guys who, you know, there's a big scene of guys who are not out, who were gay, who were recruited. It was a thing. Anyway, even though I knew, like, they're the problem and, like, we need to do something, I gotta say, the Sharps were dicks too. I mean, because then I'm glad that they're trying to do something, but it really just felt like it was this macho party where it was like, we just all want to beat each other up. And it's like, I came to see a band, man, you know? And then it just turned me off to shows, like all to those kind of punk shows altogether. And so I just started going to reggae shows. And it's been a great time because there were so many great reggae bands that came to Portland. I mean, we were like on the circuit. So for kind of the last probably year and a half or 2 years of high school, that's pretty much what I was into was reggae.
Yeah, like I think going to Portland, by the time I was going there for the first time, it was still kind of hairy, but, like, you know, I'm reading about it, it's a hard town. And there, like you're saying, there's a lot of working class poor. There was a huge Nazi scene that came in from what I've read and understood. And yeah, these shows were hairy shows from the sounds of it. And
yeah. And I mean, and even just like, you know, bands like punk bands who are like spitting on you. And I was like, I didn't push my ass to the front of the show to get spit on. But it was a huge education because, you know, then when I was in a band, it's not like I wanted to act like, you know, Mother Teresa or something, but it's like I wanted to be welcoming to people who weren't typically welcomed into shows. I'm not going to be like, I want you to spend your hard-earned money, come to my show, and then I'm going to prove how punk I am by spitting on you. I was like, that's not spitting on the three girls who are in the room isn't punk, dumbass. Like, we're just not ever going to come to these shows anymore.
That, I think that's probably the insecurity thing again, right? Like, I'm going to pick the smaller people in the room and spit on them because I know if I spit on that security guard, I'm probably going to get my ass beat.
There were no security
guards. No security guards at Satyricon, I guess. So. Did you ever see the Wipers?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that must have been amazing.
I mean, I don't remember because I was drunk, to be perfectly honest. And they reformed and I was older and I dated somebody who toured with the Wipers. But you know the thing about how Greg Sage started doing, he did sound for wrestling?
Well, I know he did that. He played guitar on Beauregard's record, the wrestler's record, but no, he did sound at wrestling events.
This is the legend I heard that he, like, you know, mic'd the mats at wrestling matches in Portland to, you know, how they make that like loud thud. It's because I mean, now they probably push a button to make the noise, but like he was doing the sound and I always thought that was really funny. I was like, I wonder if I could ever get to interview him.
Oh yeah.
We met him in Tempe. I'm sure Toby talked about it. We met him in Tempe, Arizona, on tour one time and, kind of forced ourselves on him, but, he's very quiet.
I don't think she ever told me that because Yeah, like talk about a fascinating person and an amazing, amazing band. Like a band that you hear and it's like, wow, this is truly timeless.
Yeah. And just, yeah. Something you could listen to over and over and never get sick of.
Well, you mentioned the Miracle Workers, who are now, I guess, in the Oregon Music Hall of Fame, I heard recently.
That's great.
As a band.
Didn't they turn to some kind of different music or something?
Maybe. I thought they were a garage rock band the whole way through.
I think they might have changed to a different style of music at some point. But anyway, I have to look it up. But yeah, I mean, I loved them. And that was really my introduction to garage rock, which I'm still like, I really love, like, you know, surf guitar, garage rock. I mean,
you hear that in Bikini Kill.
I used to see Theater of Sheep. They were like my favorite band. We would follow them around. And I went to school with one of the Loomis brothers. Andrew's the one from Dead Moon, right? Matt, his younger brother, went to my school. And everybody's like, he looks just like Mick Jagger.
Well, because like, I guess had you seen the Miracle Workers before you heard that comp that you talk about, the Battle of the Garages, that Plan 9 Records comp?
Oh, yeah. I'd seen them before. I mean, they were like our band that we went to every single show. And it was like, follow them or, you know, like whatever.
That comp is amazing.
The thing about Theater Sheep and them is that they hung out downtown. Like the Miracle Workers didn't hang out. Like Roz, we would have Roz. He was the lead singer of Theater of Sheep, and we would have Roz sightings. So like we were like, you know, kind of new waver theater girls. And we would like, you know, be like, I heard Roz is at the Metro Cafe. And it's like, everyone like runs to the Metro Cafe and there's like no internet or phones or anything. So it's just like, I just saw him at the Galleria. And it's like, you know, then we'd like, run over somewhere like but he hung out with Andrew Loomis and Matt Loomis sometimes, and Matt Loomis went to my school, so I was like
Dead Moon's another band that there's like so many great bands from that area, like you go start digging into it, like
Girl Trouble's
incredible, and like Mad Violets. They're not from there, right? They're from some New York.
I have I don't know anything about them. I just had that one song on the record called Psilocybe, and the singer's name is Wendy Wild.
Yeah.
Big.
I think they have like, I'm pretty sure they're from New York because I was researching that comp afterwards because I bought that comp because the Outnumbered are on it, who is John from Pansy Division's first band.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They're super awesome too. They're like, I forget what their song is on it. It's on the B side, I think. But when you mentioned in the book, I'm like, I have that compilation, and went and dug it out because
this is the first time I ever heard 125. That song 125.
Oh yeah. There's Impossible Mission Impossible. No, I can't remember all the bands on it now. There's like, it's a really cool power pop garage comp.
But so someone gave me that. I didn't like, I had no records and I just had that and I just played it over and over and over and over again. But then when I moved to Richmond, Virginia at a certain point and had a bad time working at a McDonald's doing the drive-thru, but it was right by the McDonald's I worked at was right by a record store called Plan 9.
Oh, that's and still there, I think.
Yeah. So I was like, maybe this is where the records came from. You know what I mean? Like it's like a little kid, like, you know, it's the Hershey Bar Factory. Like, you know, so I ran over there and I started just hanging out there to meet people. And I did meet some guys who were into reggae that I would like smoke pot with them in my car or in their car because I didn't have a car after my shifts at McDonald's. But back in the day, we would meet people at record stores. Like, you know, you would go to a record store. I was in Richmond, Virginia. I didn't know anybody but my sister who, again, listened to Lynyrd Skynyrd, Molly Hatchet. She had a framed picture of Alabama on her wall. So I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get through the summer with my terrible fast food job without knowing anybody who's into music or, you know, to hang out with. And so I hung out at the record store and waited for cool people to come in and then like sidled up next to him and would like say something like, what do you buy? What do you like? What's that record? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And then you end up smoking weed with them in their, you know, Scirocco.
And that's like, I think the thing that's kind of been lost, like you're talking about earlier, like the, as we've transitioned to like the streaming era and the loss of physical media, is that these spaces where you'd have to go and surrender money to buy something, but they were like meeting up places where you met like-minded people, be it bookstore, a video store, or record stores, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's the acceptable place for women to stalk people. But, you know, like, I think the thing now that's really interesting about like zines coming back and about people having a nostalgia for something they never had, which is fascinating on its own. And like, we could probably get together and write a book about it. But like, I feel like there's this nostalgia for like the handcrafted, for like the ephemeral, for something that's not going to live on the web forever, but like be in your hands. And so people are like, oh, you know, making zines or, you know, now people want one of a kind objects. Mm-hmm. Because everything's mass marketed. Everything's easy to find. And so if you can find like the band that only has two followers, how cool are you? Like the great band that has two followers. Like that's what we're looking for now. It's like we used to go to thrift stores and like I found a fucking all over print Devo shirt in a thrift store in the 90s. It was full color. I don't know who the hell made this. It was the potato with the circle thing around it with Devo. And it was all over print, front and back on the sleeves. And I gave it to Bill. And I know I have to find a picture of him wearing it because it was his size. And it was like, I was like, you have to wear this. And it was the best thrift store find. But it's like, what feeling now people go to thrift stores and they buy everything and then they sell it online. So what's the thing now for people to have that feels like a special moment for them that they dug through a crate of records and found, you know, this like Booker T record that they'd wanted that they, you know, or whatever they were looking for. And like, you have this moment and it's not even, yeah, sure. There's capitalism, surrendering of money, as you said, which I love, happening, but it's still this moment of like, this is something that's going to bring me joy beyond this moment of purchase. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to wear this awesome Devo shirt, you know, one of the best bands ever. I'm going to like, you know, wear this like one of a kind crazy thing I found at a thrift store and feel like, you know, I dug around for this.
For me, like, part of the big thing about why I started collecting records and zines is because there's that, the idea of shaking hands with the creator that you kind of get through punk, because when you bought a Discord 7-inch, you knew they folded it themselves, the early ones. I mean, like, you knew they were folding those themselves. So it's kind of like it put you in the history in a way. And I think, like you're saying, I think people just want to feel that sense of being somewhere or being part of something, like, or yeah, just,
I feel like it's like this scrambling for authenticity. Which is like really complicated because I don't really believe in authenticity, but you know what I mean? It's like, I think however it's going to play out is really interesting.
Well, I think it's, you know, you brought up zines there and now we live in this era where zines are appreciated and there's like an aesthetic zine resurgence and all this sort of thing. But I remember being in like second year university and in a class and they started talking about Girl Germs and Riot Girl and talking about these zines and talking about how this is like acceptable academic sources because these are primary sources of lived experience of people. And we could cite them in academic essays and bring zines into it and just thinking like, wow, like shift. And there's that part in the book where you talk, and I don't want to spoil everything in the book, but like, I won't go into too much detail, but like there's a part in the book where Toby's asked to drum in Nirvana and you're like, she passed it up to be in a feminist punk band, but like, yo, she kind of passed it up also to change the world in a way too. Like Nirvana changed rock and roll and huge impact. My kids love them and everything, but like, they're not allowing me to have my zines cited in academic classes in university.
Yeah, I mean, thank you.
I love the ripples, and I love the fact that like, you go to high school with one of the people that runs Simple Machine Records and like you break down.
I went
down
to junior high also because I went to junior high with Jenny Toomey from Tsunami and Simple Machines. And she beat me out for the part of Dorothy in Wizard of Oz. And they wanted me to play a munchkin, and I politely declined. And I love that I put this scene of her in the book that is something I will never, ever forget. But it was so funny when I found out Toby was, you're friends with Jenny Toomey? I went to junior high with her because, like, when the Olympia DC thing started happening, Maryland and DC are basically like scrunched up right next to each other. So a lot of those people, like Christina Ballot, I went to junior high with Christina Ballot, or Ballotte, as some people say, but from Slant Six and Autoclave and Casual Dots. And I mean, she's one of my all-time favorite singers. Like, she is so great and such a good guitar player, such a great songwriter. We're like the opposite in terms of what kind of people we are, but I absolutely adore her and I adore her work. But it was so funny. I ended up being roommates and I'm like, you seem really familiar. And she's like, we went to junior high together. And I was like, oh, because she was a year younger than me. So like, I mean.
Younger kids can't pay attention to the younger kids.
She was very quiet. I was very like feathered hair, slut, like, you know.
She like, I think was also in a band with my friend, Amy Dumas, who is professional wrestler Lita.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wrestling Hall of Famer, who was a hardcore kid, DC hardcore kid. Her and Adam live together from Jawbreaker now to really kind of like bring the whole world together in this conversation. But it's such a small world that we all live in this weird religious cult called punk.
I know. Oh, I'm running out of time.
Oh, you are? You got to go?
Because then we have, what's our slot? It was like 10:30 to...
Yeah, whenever you got to go.
I can give you 15 more, but
sure, I'll wrap up. I will go to lightning round of because there's so many questions.
I know. I feel like me, you, Sam from Born Against, from Mental Recovery Project, Ruby, Dale. Like, I'm just thinking of all these people who we should hang out with. My friend James Spooner.
I got to reach out to James about coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm halfway through it and like absolutely. Really digging this. And I also wanted to hold this up really quick because we were talking about fanzines and my friend Osato put this out and it's like all of the collected fanzines of Shotgun Seamstress. And it's gorgeous and awesome. And it's one of the only times I've seen somebody do a compilation of zines and change it into a book and be really specific and strategic about it. Because like that's part of the thing is that what happens when people are like, I want to put your zines in a book. And I feel like Bikini Kill zines are of a certain place in time. And a lot of them aren't relevant anymore because I don't agree with a lot of the ideas that I espoused then. Obviously, I still care about feminism. But I think the way I went about things was often really super from a white middle class perspective. And I don't necessarily agree with a lot of it. So do I want that immortalized in a book? Not really. I like that they existed and that, you know, people can put, you know, one thing out of it that we approve of in their academic book. But I feel like Osa did such a great job at collecting her stuff and putting some new material in it and making it something that's less ephemeral and more forever. I think mentioning when people are able to do that successfully is important for other zine writers to be able to check it out and be like, do I want to take my zine collection and make it into a book or not?
I find a lot of people don't that I've talked to. And I think it's because most people are doing them when they're younger and they're still figuring stuff out. But I think that's what makes them so important. Like there's that part in the book where you talk about Toby mentioning the mistake left on the Rites of Spring record. And I feel like that's what the imperfection of the zine is what makes them a human form of communication and makes them real. And the fact that people can evolve through these zines because you're like figuring stuff out in real time. And it's, I think that's why there's
part of the reason that you can do that or that I could do that was because I knew it was ephemeral. I knew it wasn't going to follow me throughout my whole life. I could just print 100 copies, sell them and be done with it or, you know, more like, and then be done with it. And then the computer came and people started photographing pages of the zines and putting it on the computer, on the internet, where it lives forever and it's not dated. And so people sometimes will think like, I wrote this one Riot Girl manifesto yesterday. You know what I mean? Or like a couple years ago. And it's like, no, that was written like 30 years ago, but they're not dated. And so that's like a, it's an interesting combination of how does something that was once thought of as ephemeral, you know, it's like, we didn't have DNA back then. You know what I mean? Like, there are all these new scientific inventions that have happened that have like changed the way that we think about the world, and that change what's ephemeral and what's not ephemeral, and who gets to decide that somebody's ephemeral expression, you know, you take a picture of what they wrote in the sand and then you put it on the internet and now it's forever.
Well, and I think it's like this, also this idea, going back to what we talked about earlier, where this is a moment in your life where someone clings on to it, taking this in, and that becomes you as the totality of who this person is. And, you know, I always talk about it, it must be a nightmare being Ian MacKay, still having to talk about straight edge at like 50 something years old, still have to justify to people that are pissed off about it. Or, you know, like, it's just like, oh my gosh, like this shit that you do as a teenager follows you around. But punk is the place where we value the words of kids so much, youth, you know, so much that, like, I still listen to music made by teenagers like every day. Like, I,
oh yeah, no, me too.
So it's such a weird thing. One of my favorite parts in the book is when Tim Mack from Halo of Flies comes out and records you, and just first of all, the Viva Knievel 7-inch is fucking underrated. That's an amazing record. But when, and I just, the way you describe it and the experience of it just made it, I don't know, it's just such a cool story. And I love that band, Halo of Flies.
Yeah, I mean, what a weird thing. Because, like, I don't think anybody would associate, you know, Halo of Flies and Bikini Kill or, like, My Voice or anything like that. And that really was one of those moments, sort of like the Steve Hanford thing. It's, like, where somebody who was kind of, like, in the underground community, doing stuff, making things happen, a participant, said, I like you. Welcome. You know what I mean? And it's like, when you're constantly running up against like kind of doors being slammed in your face or you being laughed at, you cling to those moments like life rafts. Like, you know, I'd be like, well, fucking the guy from Halo of Flies liked my voice, so fuck you. You know? And it's like, it probably didn't mean shit to him. He probably doesn't even remember he did it. He's probably going to be like, did I do that? Like, but it meant so much to me. It meant so, and then with the experience that happened right after that, which let's not talk about, that it really, it helped me. I don't know if there are these moments that you're like, I don't, you string them together and you're like, these are the things that kept me going through the years. And they probably meant nothing to the person. And I think that's part of the thing that I wanted to say in the book, is that like giving each other permission and while we're still alive on this earth, saying, not just with our words, but with our actions, welcome. Or, hey, let me help you out with that when you can, when you have the ability to be like, you know, a older person who's a mentor who like loves someone's music. And it's like, hey, could I record a single for you? Could I, you know what I mean? Like, you want to crash at my house? Like Sonic Youth let us crash at their place in New York. And that was huge. Bikini Kill was not well loved at that time period. And so it was kind of in my head, I'd be like, okay, so all you guys hate me, but Kim Gordon thinks I'm cool, so I'm okay.
And like you were saying earlier, at the beginning of this thing, like the having your heroes become your peers is ultimate punk validation, because it's not going to be commercial success. It's not going to be maybe being appreciated by the scene en masse, but in your time at least. But but knowing that there's people that you respected and that inspired you to make art that turn around and say, no, what you're doing is fucking awesome, is just, I can't think of anything more validating as an artist.
Well, yeah, Sonic Youth did that for us at a time where it was just like hate, 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 violence, 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 violence. So it was like really like, you know, sleeping on the floor of their apartment meant so much to me as a young woman in a band. And it was probably no big deal to them. But to me, it was like, you know, there still is a community for me. There still is a safe place for me. There still is people who care, you know?
I honestly could talk to you forever and a day. If you ever want to come back on,
yeah, definitely,
the door is always open. Before I go, like, coming back now, like having that tumultuous run in the beginning with the band and having to carve these paths in a lot of ways, like coming back now, like on this last couple tours, I was just wondering your perspective on how things have changed. Like, do you, because it really does feel like the adulation, like the palpable adulation, was something I don't think I've ever experienced that in another show, like I did at your show here not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's great. I mean, I just feel like we're being treated normal, like how we should have been treated in the beginning. You know, yeah. Like we're making decent money. We have good people that we're working with so that I'm not having to deal with sound men refusing to plug in my monitor if I don't tell them if I'm single or married. You know, like it's just nice to be treated normal and be like, oh, I'm a musician and I show up and I do my sound check and I have a tour manager who I enjoy being around and who treats us so respectfully and takes care of us. And
one of the best people in the business, Ben.
Yeah.
Ben Hardskin, one of the best out there.
Yeah. Great, great guy. Great stories. Lovely human being. So lucky to work with him. And so it's like, you know, and our, you know, Tobin, like we work with great people. And we always have great sound people and monitor people. And like, that's stuff we couldn't afford back then. And I guess if I leave you with one idea, because you had said like, oh, if there's anything you forgot to say, is that one of the things that disturbs me or keeps me up at night is when I think about young bands now, and I think about how, you know, it's harder now to make money than it was even then. And it's really based on touring, and COVID is not gone. So people can end up losing a lot of money on a tour if they get sick, especially bands that aren't as big as what Bikini Kill is now. Bands who are forging new paths in punk rock and in music in general are the ones who really need a crew. They need a sound person who isn't going to hate them because of their race or their gender presentation, or, you know, they're not going to, if you're a young trans kid in a band, you can't have a sound person who hates trans people and wants to sabotage your show controlling your voice. Like, that's what's terrifying to me, is to have someone who hates you just because of who you are. And again, this goes for whether it's racial or because you're trans or because, you know, you're a woman or, you know, a trans woman or a trans man or whatever. It's like, there are people there are straight white cisgender men who are out there in the world who will hate you just because of who you are. And they will sabotage your show by turning your vocals down so you throw your voice out and then you miss the next show. And having someone like that, literally controlling your voice, the fact that you have come all the way to this place to share your ideas with a group of people, and then you have a straight white cisgender man who hates you, turning you up and down at their will, is a problem. It's a psychological problem in the mind of a singer. And it's also just a like economic problem. And so like, I really want to be like, I'm thinking of starting a grant program or something like that, where it's like to give grants to young bands to get their own sound people.
There's so much I want to talk to you about. And but I can't keep you all
day. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, it's absolutely. Like
the very bands that need it the most can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And when you're just starting out and you're actually saying stuff that is against the status quo, or just being who you are is considered being against the status quo, it's like you're the exact people who are not going to make money and who are going to be kept tamped down, and you're not going to be able to have that stuff. And I can't tell you how much having our own sound person has changed my life. So I want other bands to have that, especially young bands, because that's the only way things are going to grow, and that these bands are going to be able to develop and be making their 12th record, where we get to see their growth from the very beginning. So, yeah.
Well, and when you start the program or anytime you want to come back and talk about any of it, this door is always open to you.
Yeah, I have to figure out what the application process would be. It's like, then I'm a gatekeeper, you know, but whatever.
Thank you, Kathleen, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Kathleen will be back for part two, hopefully a splits. Hopefully we get more, another chance to talk, because I got like three more sheets worth of questions I didn't get to ask. So pick up Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk, on HarperCollins, out on May 14th. You can pre-order it at your local bookstore now. And there's some stuff in this book. I'm powerful stuff, fascinating stuff, stuff we didn't obviously talk about at all in this podcast. That well worth your time to pick up this book and read it. Speaking of well worth your time, on the next episode of Turn Into Punk, another great conversation with someone who involved with punk music. It's a punk rock bowling episode, so you'll hear whatever I've got planned for that one when it happens. That's it for today's show. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different races, different faiths, different ethnicities, different nationalities, different identities, because we're not talking about politics. This is just basic human rights stuff. Ceasefires are just basic human rights stuff. People deserve to be able to live free from hate and violence. So if there's organizations that are affecting positive change in your community, get involved. Donate your time, your support in any way you can, and sign your organ donor card, because by the time they come looking for those things, those organs, you don't need them anymore. It's not like that Monty Python sketch that was horribly ripped off by You Can't Do That on Television. They wait till you don't need those organs, and then they can provide real miracles. I've seen it happen with my own eyes. Not literally as the operation's happening, but the recovery when the miracle kind of happened, like, yeah, I was there and I saw it. So sign those cards. Try meditating. You don't have to sign up for anything. You don't have to, you know, just lots of free opportunities to try this thing out. And people have been doing it for centuries and it works. I'm just one of the more recent people to stumble upon it. And it worked for me, so maybe it'll work for you. And then go out there and make your own punk culture, because anyone can do this shit. Start a band, start a fanzine, write a book, write a movie. Write a movie and put me in it, you know? Oh, man, I'm tired. I've had no sleep this whole week. This is the end of the show. If you're still listening, I'm just going to ramble. You're way past the point to get off this ride. So now you just got to sit here and hear the worn out old carnival worker controlling the roller coaster ramble on. Anyway, I'm really tired, so I'm going to stop rambling, and I'm going to see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening. It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turn Out of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening. And you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front and everything in between. This festival is out of control. for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 28th.